From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tomorrow, the U.S. Senate is set to vote on the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Last week, the House approved the same measure. The pipeline would transport hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil from Canada to Gulf refineries. It would cut through Nebraska, Montana, and South Dakota. Supporters promise job creation and cheaper oil, but critics warn of oil spills and skyrocketing emissions. This hour, On Point, jobs, economics, the environment, and the Keystone Pipeline. You can join us on air or online. Do you support the Keystone Pipeline, or do you see it as an environmental disaster waiting to happen? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us first today from Washington is Alana Shore. She's an energy reporter from Politico and has been tracking the Keystone Pipeline from the beginning. Alana, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Jessica.
So let's just lay this out. For 6 years, this thing has been in limbo. It has been rejected by the federal government, reconsidered, remapped, and it's still on hold. Why is the Senate voting on it now?
It starts with Senator Mary Landrieu, a Louisiana Democrat who's locked in a really tough runoff that is December 6th against a Republican named Bill Cassidy. Landrieu has been chair of the Senate Energy Committee while Democrats have been in charge. Of course, they lost control on Election Day. Right now, Landrieu is on the ropes. Polls show her down by double digits. So she's seized on the Keystone Pipeline, which she's also been, to be fair, a huge supporter of for years, and really mounted kind of a last-ditch quest to save her neck by getting her own party to agree to a vote on it. That said, it was all but certain to come up as perhaps even the first issue Republicans take up next year. What's surprising now is that Landrieu is pushing it and seeing so much success this early.
So how do you think the vote is likely to come out?
Right now, she's one vote short of what we call the magic number in the Senate, which is 60, to break a filibuster that would send the bill to President Obama's desk. And that happened because the House actually agreed on Friday to pass the exact same bill that Landrieu has introduced. Now, this is the ninth vote the House has taken on Keystone. This one's especially significant, though, because they basically took the language of the Senate bill and attached Landrieu's opponent's name on it to the House. So what we're looking at is a highly personal kind of competition between Landrieu and her opponent over who gets their name on it and who gets to take the most credit.
This sounds a little crazy, what you're describing. We're talking about a pipeline that would cover like 2,000 miles, many states, and yet it's all about local politics in one state, in Louisiana. Is that what you're telling us?
Well, at this point, it is. Depending on what happens with this month's fight over Keystone, we could see the same fight come up again next year, since the president is expected to veto it, with a completely different cast, which is much more about the GOP majority versus the president. Right now, though, it is a lot about Louisiana.
Okay. We'll get to the larger environmental and political issues, but you did mention the president is likely to veto it. Tell us a little bit about why and what happens if he does.
The president has long said that both sides of this argument are kind of exaggerating their talking points. One side, you know, the industry and Republican-backed side, says there'll be tens of thousands of jobs. This is a huge economic stimulus. The other side, the environmentalists, say this is a disaster. It will be devastating to climate change. The White House has signaled for years now that it thinks both of those arguments are overblown. What it's waiting on and why the president is likely to veto is a dispute over the pipeline's path through Nebraska that started with a court case filed by three landowners and ended up invalidating the state law that was passed to push through very quickly a new path for Keystone. This was back in 2012. So the White House wants this process in Nebraska to be wrapped up before it actually makes a final call. And that could happen, frankly, at any time. The Nebraska court could rule this week or it could rule next spring.
Okay, so just to wrap that up, if the president does veto it, Keystone, to be clear, is still in limbo until the court rules, potentially.
Potentially, or until next year, when we'll have at least four new Republican votes for this pipeline, which could bring the GOP close to a veto-proof majority. And that would, of course, force the president's hand. However, in the House, they're much further from a veto-proof majority. So a lot remains uncertain about whether they can push the president on this in 2015.
this is going to go on for a while, it sounds like. Let's, Alana, just hang on for one moment. I'd like to bring in former Governor Brian Schweitzer, former governor of Montana, and he's now chairman of Stillwater Mining Company. The governor, I understand you're in Georgetown Lake, Montana. Thanks for being with us and On Point, Governor.
Well, great to be with you. And, of course, this is another issue. The president's exactly right. This is Congress with more motion masquerading as action. Listen, pipelines are permitted state by state. All pipelines are. The only pipelines that need to have the State Department, which actually works for the president, to approve of it are the ones that cross the international border. You know, both the left and the right have got this wrong. The Republicans say it's 10,000 jobs, it's oil security, all the rest of it. There's already 20 pipelines that cross the border from Canada that are carrying these oil sands. The rail system in Canada, Montana, North and South Dakota is completely full of crude oil that's coming out of Alberta. You're not going to stop the development of these oil sands by stopping one pipeline. There's 160,000 miles of pipelines that crisscross America today. There's 16,000 miles of pipelines that crisscross Nebraska. And yet, in Nebraska, they say all those pipelines are okay, but this new one, designed today and built today, more sophisticated than any pipeline built in Nebraska, is the one we don't like.
You make a great point in that this is a flashpoint. It's become a flashpoint for environmentalists, primarily because it does cross this international border and therefore the president has a say on it, whereas some of these other pipelines have been built without becoming such a cause celeb for the environmental movement. Let me ask you, though, clearly for a moment, explain to us why you're for it. You supported it as governor. Why do you want it?
Because TransCanada came to see me in Helena as the governor of Montana, and they said, we're going to propose another pipeline across the border into Montana, and it would start up here in Hardisty, Alberta, and it would end up going to the Gulf Coast. I said, that's interesting. It goes right through the Bakken of North Dakota and Montana, where we've markedly increased our oil production, and we don't have good pipeline capacity, so we have to ship it on rail, which is not nearly as safe, not nearly as efficient. So I said to him, if you'll agree to have 20% of the oil that goes on this pipeline, you'll get a permit to come through Montana. They said, are you holding us hostage? I said, yep. And so this isn't just about Canadian oil. This would be 20% of sweet crude coming from North Dakota and Montana, and it would decrease the amount of oil that would have to go on these rails.
Jessica, a quick note about what the governor has said. All that is true in terms of his role in this, which was huge in getting this U.S. on-ramp. However, only 100,000 of the 830,000 barrels thus far have been publicly set aside for that Bakken crude. It may ultimately increase, but I want to be clear that right now it's less than 20%, according to the government documents.
And that's true, but you see, these are private. These are between private companies, the oil producers in North Dakota and Montana, and TransCanada, and those are private contracts that have been written between them. The on-ramp, yeah, that is for a minimum of that amount of oil to go on that pipeline.
Let me bring in, because we've had commenters write in already from on Facebook and on Twitter. This is an issue people get passionate about. I've read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5... almost 10 comments, even before the show started, from a listener saying the pipeline should be blocked. There's no good reason for the U.S. to take the risks involved in it while not necessarily receiving the benefits. Governor, would you address that kind of criticism?
I would. You know, the hyperbole around these heavy oils is reaching the level of ridiculous. Actually, what happens right now is Venezuelan heavy crude, which is very similar chemistry to the heavy crude coming out of Alberta, the so-called oil sands, is being refined along the Gulf Coast. This oil coming from Canada would supplant the oil that we're bringing from Venezuela, and these refineries have already been built to handle this heavy crude. They wouldn't have to modify their refineries to handle this heavy crude. When you switch from a light crude or a sour crude to a heavy crude, there's millions, hundreds of millions of dollars spent. So this is just one more pipeline delivering another source of oil to refineries in the United States. And I would much rather get the oil from our friends in Alberta, where I've never sent the Montana National Guard to their border, than have to get it from Venezuela or Saudi Arabia or Iraq.
So, Governor, Democrats are coming out of the closet on this, saying they supported Keystone. They want to vote for this tomorrow. Not all of the party, but more than we've seen before. Do you think this new Senate vote is really all about politics?
Of course. In fact, a Senate vote, a House vote doesn't matter at all. It's the State Department who decides this. This isn't even the role of Congress. They should look at the Constitution. The State Department works for the President of the United States.
But they've already given their review to the President.
That's all.
But, you know, they've already given their review to the President. Do you have any sense, Governor, why the President has waited so long? I mean, he could have come down for it, against it. Just make a decision.
Make a decision? Why? Right now, you have a pipeline that is permitted to make it to the prairie of South Dakota and stop. Right now, if you permitted that pipeline, you would be derelict in your duty because you're permitting a pipeline that doesn't even have a route across Nebraska. What you would be permitting is a pipeline that cannot get to Kansas, so it means it's dumping it on the prairie or you have to send it across to Nebraska on a rail. There is not a complete application. I'm for it, but there's not a complete application. I can't blame the President for that.
Alana, go ahead. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to what you'd said, Jessica, which is the process actually isn't done. What state has given the President is the environmental review. There's an executive order that was signed by President George W. Bush in 2004 that actually tells state to do what they call a national interest review. So it's not just environmental, it's economic, it's geopolitical, the type of energy security questions that Governor Schweitzer was just talking about. That wasn't done yet. So when people talk about the review being done, they really just mean the environmental part, and there actually is a Bush-signed order that says it's bigger.
So he does have
reason. You can't complete a pipeline application until you have a completed route. And you don't have a completed route because it stops in Nebraska. If the Republicans would like to have a pipeline across Nebraska, perhaps they should contact the Republican governor, lieutenant governor, all three members of Congress who are Republicans, both senators who are Republicans, and a legislature, while it's considered nonpartisan, is actually about two-thirds Republican. That's a good place to start.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Keystone Pipeline and what it would mean for the U.S. and that protest you hear. Well, it's the sound of hundreds of environmental activists objecting to the pipeline outside the U.S. Capitol. So join in this conversation. Should the U.S. Senate vote to approve the pipeline tomorrow? Is it right for the environment and the economy? Joining us on the phone is Alana Shore from Washington. She's Politico's energy reporter. And from Georgetown Lake, Montana, we have former Governor Brian Schweitzer. Governor, you heard those protests. In fact, the polling shows most of the public actually supports pipeline construction. Most of the public also believes, possibly erroneously, that it will create many, many long-term jobs. If the President does veto this legislation tomorrow, do you think he'll be hurt by that choice?
I don't. I think this is sort of almost like a fart in a windstorm. Just move on, and they'll have some other explanations as we move forward. Listen, if the environmental community would really like to move the dial, then stand in front of this Congress and say to them, approve the production tax credit so that we can continue to get tax benefits for solar and wind. Stand in front of them and say, join the 25 states like Montana that have already passed the renewable portfolio standard so that 15% of our electricity will be generated from solar and wind power. You want to move the dial. Let's move us in the direction that's to the future instead of arguing about the past.
Do you believe with absolute certainty this will bring the U.S. closer to energy independence? There's an argument that this oil won't actually be sold inside the U.S., so it might have an economic benefit, but not necessarily an energy benefit.
Well, it'll be sold in the United States because it'll be shipped to the Gulf Coast. It'll be refined at the Gulf Coast. And as long as we're net importers of oil, the pipeline system is built along the Gulf Coast to deliver that diesel and gasoline to the interior pipelines of the United States to all of these gas stations. But look, this pipeline is one pipeline out of 20 that already crossed in from Canada. You're already moving it on the rail. They're building another pipeline to the east coast of Canada. They could put it on a boat and bring it on around to the Gulf Coast. You're not going to stop the oil development in Alberta by stopping one pipeline. That's kind of silly.
So, Alana, will you just go ahead? Yeah,
sorry. I was just going to say, I agree with much of what the governor is saying in terms of the unstoppability, if that could be called a word, of this oil. What environmentalists are playing is just a giant game of whack-a-mole. But as you said earlier, Jessica, this is as much about the symbolism of this one pipeline as it is about the actual barrels this pipeline would carry. They're targeting the president because they lost on a Congress-centered approach to pass a cap-and-trade bill years ago. They targeted Congress. They failed. Now they're looking at a much simpler issue that the president can come out on, even just rhetorically, to set what the president himself has called a, quote, climate test for these big infrastructure projects. So it's really about future pipelines as well.
And to the question of energy independence, Ilana, there is no guarantee that they will sell a certain amount of this oil to the U.S.
Absolutely not. As the governor said, though, it will be refined in the U.S. And keep in mind, oil and gas products are our number one export right now. That's huge for our balance of trade, huge for job creation. So for listeners, it's important to understand there's this raw oil type product coming down. It'll be processed entirely in America, but it'll be sold on the global market. And there's no way anybody can give you assurances who will be buying that.
So let's bring in some of our callers. David is calling from Woodbury, Connecticut. Hi, David. What's on your mind?
Well, one thing that was a particular concern, I found out just within the last 2 days that the aquifer under Nebraska is particularly close to the surface. And, gosh, I hearing earlier in the show that this is a new type of pipeline. It's still out of steel. And I would think underground leaks would be inevitable.
David, thank you for the call, Governor.
I'll jump on that one. I am a soil scientist, and so I can talk about the Ogallala Aquifer at length. The Ogallala Aquifer is another one of those aquifers that's huge. It runs from South Dakota to West Texas, all across Kansas and eastern Colorado, and, of course, Nebraska. But you see, David, oil is not water-soluble. So if you leak oil along the surface, even if it rains, it's not going to wash it 50 or 100 feet into the Ogallala Aquifer. And if Nebraska was concerned about that aquifer and oil, why did they allow 16,000 miles of pipelines to already be built across Nebraska? And they permitted 10,000 oil and gas wells that drill right through the Ogallala Aquifer to oil and gas beneath it. If there was a chance of oil and gas getting into the Ogallala Aquifer, it would be much greater developing oil and gas beneath it and bringing it through it than it would be from above it. So that
can
is
I jump in on this for a second?
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yes, it is true that there are also a lot of other pipelines through the Ogallala Aquifer. I've actually been to where this pipeline would run through the Ogallala. It's a particularly sensitive region of northern Nebraska called the Sand Hills, where I've been on landowners' farms and seen them actually jam a well that can just bubble up to the surface within minutes. The water table is very, very high at very, very certain portions of the Ogallala. The former governor is right. Lots of oil pipelines cross this aquifer. This is a very unique issue because it's this, like, just a couple of counties in Nebraska where the landowners are very, very concerned. That said, there's not a lot of science that says even if there is a leak, it would contaminate vast amounts of this area. We're literally talking about perhaps dozens of farms or less in the event of a leak.
And, Governor, you pointed out earlier that it's not as though this oil isn't going to move through the U.S. anyway. It's currently being moved on rail, and that poses a threat of its own.
Crossing rivers all across America. It's running right through main streets of some of the biggest cities in America. There is no way that moving this oil on rail is safer than it is in pipelines. And there's no way that this pipeline designed this year and built this year isn't safer than the 160,000 miles of pipelines that have been built as much as 50 years ago. Would you rather be in a wreck in a 1958 Chevy or in a 2014 Impala? You pick.
So if you describe tomorrow's vote, Governor, as a fart in a windstorm, if it's that meaningless, what will make the ultimate decision?
I think the ultimate decision is going to be business, because actually the Keystone XL pipeline, the necessity for it, has passed by. There are new pipelines proposed to come out of the Bakken and move that oil to their markets. There are already 20 pipelines that are moving that oil across the border into the United States. There's a pipeline proposed that will go to the east coast of Canada. And then there will be a pipeline probably built to the west coast of Canada. So it could be that TransCanada and the Keystone XL pipeline won't get built, and simply because there will be other conduits before they get this one built.
Delay.
I wouldn't disagree with that. We wrote a story just last month in Politico called The Incredible Shrinking Keystone that spoke not just about what the governor just mentioned, but also politically. A lot of these environmental groups who are protesting the pipeline supported candidates who also think the pipeline's a good idea in the last election.
We'll get to that point, Ilana, in a moment. Governor, you always speak so colorfully. We're glad to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us today, former governor of Montana, Brian Schweitzer.
Stay warm.
Thanks. Alana, stay with us, because joining us now from Omaha, Nebraska, one of the states the new pipeline would cut through, is Ernest Goss. He's professor of regional economics at Creighton University. Professor Goss, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Jessica. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And also from St. Paul, Minnesota, David Keith joins us, professor of public policy and applied physics at Harvard University. He's also an environmental scientist and author of the book A Case for Climate Engineering. Professor Keith, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be back.
So, Professor Goss, let me start with you, because you're in Nebraska. Would you give us a sense of the mood on the ground? What is the talk there? Do most people you encounter want this thing built?
Well, Jessica, at Creighton, we do a survey each month of bank CEOs in 10 states, and one of those states is Nebraska. And we ask the bankers about the support for the pipeline. 80% to 90% support, at least according to the bankers. Now, that's their support. Now, in terms of gauging the public support, I think there is a majority of Nebraskans do support it, but there is significant resistance.
So, in terms of the resistance, partly has to do with, I imagine, confusion over the facts to some extent. Can we lay out some of the facts as you understand them? What will the pipeline do in terms of jobs and economic growth?
Well, according to my estimates, about 3,800 jobs over the course of 2 years, and that's in Nebraska. That's 2015 and 16. So 3,800 jobs in Nebraska. Across the three states, probably around 14,000 jobs for 15 and 16. Of course, as everyone says, those are temporary jobs. But, of course, all construction jobs are temporary jobs. What about the follow-on jobs in terms of maintenance and operations of the pipeline? And those will, of course, be much smaller, but there will be jobs there as well.
Now, Professor Goss, TransCanada, the company that's building the pipeline, they put out wildly different estimates. They said it could create 42,000 jobs total that would be ongoing and enduring. But the State Department said only 50 jobs, and you've given us a number in between. How do you make sense of all these facts?
The 50 jobs, I'm not familiar with that estimate. I don't get that. I've seen none of the 50 job estimates. But in terms of my estimate for operations, that would be beyond 2017, would be about 130 jobs in Nebraska. And if you triple that for Montana and South Dakota, because individuals out there need to understand that the southern portion of the XL pipeline is already open for business. That was last year. So we're talking about the northern portion of the XL pipeline, which runs through Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska. So that's the portion we're talking about.
Okay. Well,
Jessica, can I jump in here on that 50 jobs number? Because
sure.
I can tell you where it comes from.
Sure.
TransCanada had to tell the State Department the number of permanent operating jobs it expected for the project. That's where the 50 jobs number
comes
from.
I disagree with that number. In other words, the numbers that I'm seeing, I won't say they're still not very large, but they're larger than that. 50 jobs, I don't know where. Is that across the three states? That's I would say, an absurd estimate and very low.
We can agree. Again, it wasn't broken down. It just came from TransCanada's own filings. The 42,000 jobs are indirect jobs, which could exist as far away as, say, Colorado, where they might make some parts for the pipeline. And those would be also two-year jobs.
But those would be direct and indirect. 42,000 includes the indirect as well.
All right. We can agree
exactly.
That there are a lot of conflicting and confusing facts. I'd like to bring in Professor Keith, because we want to speak to the environmental aspect of this. Professor, we know environmentalists are passionate in their opposition. Is Keystone really an environmental disaster waiting to happen?
No individual pipeline makes that much difference. The issue here is entirely political. The environmental community has chosen, whether by sense or luck or bad luck, to make this a central fight. And it's part of a larger, as Alana said, giving up on the kind of air war in Washington, D.C. and focusing on a ground game that includes attacking coal plant builds, coal plant exports, and major new oil infrastructure like Keystone XL. But the pipeline itself doesn't change very much. Even the people in the middle of the environmental community know that.
So, Professor Keith, one of the things we heard Governor Schweitzer saying earlier is that a lot of environmentalists are concerned building the pipeline will encourage development of the tar sands, the oil fields in Canada. Would you explain that opposition, the logic of that opposition?
Sure. The logic of that opposition is if you want a stable climate, you don't want to build a lot of long-lived infrastructure that takes carbon out of the ground. And in that place, it's entirely sensible for people to oppose Keystone and other major oil infrastructure. And I spend about half my life in Alberta. I've lived there for 10 years. a lot of my neighbors who are on the oil patch, there's no question that they are constrained for export. And they especially see that in what's called the light-heavy differential, the difference between the kind of standard oil prices reported in the news and the oil price for heavy oil in Alberta. That differential is big, and that is, and they see that if this pipeline was built, the differential would get smaller, and that would no question drive new investment in the oil patch.
Okay, we're getting into technicalese now, so I'm going to pause and ask Professor Keith to answer this question. Would you simply explain what is the difference between an oil field, an oil shale, a tar field? What are we talking about here?
You ready for a big lecture?
Yeah.
Oil sand, when you pick it up in your hand, looks like if you leaked motor oil onto your driveway, onto sand in your driveway, and let it sit in the sun for a year or so. So it's congealed sand wet with oil. And it's either extracted by huge digging operations or by underground operations where steam is pumped in. And there's really two big places in the world, one in Alberta and the other one in Venezuela, where that kind of extraction happens. Oil shales or other tight oil are more like conventional oil formations. The only difference is that the material is so impermeable that it's hard for oil to flow through by just putting a regular oil well down, and instead you have to put a bunch of little fractures in a long horizontal well, and those help the oil seep out.
And that's what, and in Alberta, they're using the special process to extract it from these oil shale.
No. Alberta is famous for this huge oil sand or tar sands resource that in terms of total producible oil is on par with the resource in Saudi Arabia. And so the most sort of optimistic from the viewpoint of the Alberta oil industry views have production going to, you know, north of 5 million barrels a day, which would put Alberta at, you know, one of the major oil producers in the world. It already is a very big one, and producing something like 5% of world supply.
And is there any evidence, Professor Keith, that this is that the production in Alberta would slow down or stop if Keystone were blocked?
I think the evidence is how angry and worried people are. I think you can see the evidence in all the internal reports from the Alberta oil patch and the public consulting reports, which are evident. So the environmental community, both in the U.S. and in Canada and elsewhere, has been fighting pipeline by pipeline. And so Governor Schweitzer mentioned that there were other pipelines like Northern Gateway running to British Columbia or the pipeline that might run across Canada. Both of those are given low odds of success by most experts. So the answer is that lack of pipeline capacity is restricting investment.
It's also important to note that the State Department acknowledged, even as it said Keystone would not have a significant environmental impact, that if oil got around $65 to $75 per barrel, it could. There was a bigger window, so to speak, for blocking this pipeline to actually have a significant impact on oil sands production and therefore potentially the climate. Oil is about $75 a barrel now, so we're reaching kind of a new point in this analysis.
And I mean, you think of this from the perspective of a giant investor, you know, a big global fund that would put money into Alberta oil sands. With the difficulty of getting oil out, which makes the product less valuable because that heavy oil is less valuable, it's harder to get to market, and global oil prices being lower, people are less likely to put money into development, and that means less development is likely to happen.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about U.S. energy and the Keystone Pipeline. You can join the conversation. Is the construction of Keystone really a dire threat to the environment? What does the falling price of gas mean for Keystone and for U.S. energy independence? Alana Shore is joining us from Washington. She's the energy reporter for Politico. From Omaha, Nebraska is Ernie Goss, regional economics professor at Creighton University. And with us from St. Paul, Minnesota is David Keith, environmental scientist and professor of public policy and applied physics at Harvard University. Professor Goss, I wanted to give you a chance to address the tumbling price of oil and its impact on a Keystone construction. TransCanada's own consultant estimated it would cost between $85 to $110 to produce this oil for them. But right now, oil is trading even lower than that at $76. So is this no longer a profitable endeavor?
At its current levels, I think it is. It's a break-even point, in my estimation, is $70 to $75 a barrel. Now, there's three factors bringing oil prices down. The value of the dollar is up significantly. Global oil supplies are up significantly. And global demand, because of a slowing global economy, is down. So that's not going to last. In other words, we're talking about 2017 production generating oil in 2017. I think beyond that period of time, we're going to have a significant upturn in oil prices. For example, Goldman Sachs estimates that oil prices next year will be between $80 and $85 a barrel. I think beyond 2015, they will be even higher, making it very profitable to bring oil from Canada.
Daniel is on the phone from Bowling Green, Kentucky, with a comment on this. Hi, Daniel. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm calling as a small oil producer, and my concern is the public seems to have, you know, a lot of anger towards the petroleum industry, and it is a non-renewable resource, but, you know, we need this infrastructure in order to move the product around the United States, and it's extremely important, and I just would hope, you know, that the American people would, you know, as far as go along with a lot of these products and what we're doing, because a lot of the pipelines, we've been working, you know, 50, 60 years, and it's, you know, in accordance with state and federal regulations. And there are inspectors there on site, you know, and it's not like, you know, we're just going to build a pipeline and walk away. So,
thanks for the call. Thanks, Daniel, for the call. Professor Goss, he's a small mom-and-pop operator, an oil producer. Do you hear that kind of comment from a lot of folks there in Nebraska?
There are a lot of comments like that. And I think we hear the president and we hear Congress talking about infrastructure spending. We need more infrastructure spending. Here we have the opportunity to get it out from somebody other than the taxpayer. I think that's very important. And to correct where Alana and I are in probably agreement, the job numbers I talked about, the 400 jobs – three states in operation. That's direct and indirect, not just the direct. So maybe the 50, they're talking about direct only.
Indeed they are.
You are good at fact-checking, Alana. Thank you for being here with us. I love this. Brian is now on the line from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jessica. You know, I really just want to know, I mean, if there is an environmental impact, you know, is the company responsible for cleaning that up? And regardless of the number of jobs, just how much revenue do these states see by allowing oil, you know, going across their state? And that's it.
Two excellent questions. Let me put the first piece of that question to you, Professor Keith. Who is responsible if there's some sort of environmental spill?
Well, the gentleman said impact, and the question is, what's the impact? So the direct impact of a spill, the answer is companies responsible, and it's not perfect, but more or less it works. And I think nobody who really understands the way pipeline works is that worried about the direct impacts of spill. The reason the environmental community is so worried about this is not because of spills, although they sometimes say that for tactical reasons. The reason they're worried about it is because of the increase, the extent to which it's part of an increase in carbon going to the air. And the companies are not responsible for that. That's part of a global problem of climate pollution. And I think the way this gets mixed up is that there's really two completely different fights going on here. And so the gentleman who spoke, who was a small producer, sounds just like small producers who I run into in Alberta. And his point of view is, in a sense, entirely reasonable. The question is how we move away from oil slowly, we need it now, to something that produces less CO2.
I want to take partial issue, though, with something Professor Keith said. He is definitely correct that the majority of Keystone opponents have a climate case against it. There is, however, a small vocal contingent of mostly Nebraskan landowners who are arguably the only reason the president has successfully, you know, staved off a call on this, who are concerned about spills. But that goes back, Jessica, to what I was saying earlier about this really only being a matter of leaks affecting a few dozen landowners. They, however, are pretty vocal. Some of them are in D.C. today, and they like to tell you that this oil, if there is a spill, there's some questions about whether oil sands producers actually pay into what we call the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, which is the government's big pot of money that gets released to help the EPA clean up oil spills. Because oil sands wasn't originally defined technically in bureaucrat ease as an oil decades ago, there is some uncertainty. We can't be sure whether they're fully paying in. Democrats love to talk about this.
Interesting.
Jessica, to that last point about the impact, ongoing impact, about the installed cost of the Keystone XL pipeline, the northern portion is about $1.1 billion. There'll be property taxes on that to the tune of about $22 million per year, 1.5% to 2% of the installed value. So there is an ongoing positive impact as some of the counties see it. It goes across 12 Nebraska counties, and they will generate significant property taxes each year.
And will there also be property taxes generated in the other states it crosses through?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Usually around 1.5% to 2% of the install value. And again, the install value across the three states is about $1.1 billion.
I think we're getting lost in the weeds here. It's absolutely true that there are local property owners who will be hit. That's true for any infrastructure development. And those people are, no question, an important part of the opposition. But if that was all there was, if there wasn't this larger climate fight where, for better or for worse, a whole bunch of big money on the side of trying to get climate action had decided to put its money, its poker chips, I don't think we'd be having this conversation. The thing would have been approved. So the central thing that's sticking for the president, I think, is the climate fight.
I agree, but in a sense, though, it was the Nebraskans who filed this lawsuit. So you're looking at two pretty integral parts. I think without either one, we wouldn't be seeing what we're seeing today.
Let's take a call for a moment from Doug. He's calling from Proctorville, Vermont. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Hi, Jessica.
What's on your mind?
Just a lot of things. Well, number one, the jobs thing is a joke. It just gets people riled up. I've been to East Texas. I've been on the pipeline route. There's nobody there now. All the pump stations are operated by satellite dish and computers. And let's not forget that this thing is still installed by, you know, it's a rudimentary system. I've watched them welding it. They put it in the pipe in the ditch, and they've had thousands of problems called anomalies. Dents in the pipe, bad welds. So this thing is not, like, the most perfect thing ever. Let's get that straight. And then one thing y'all are talking about are the affected people in Canada, where they're extracting it, the tar sands, the First Nations, and then the affected people in Houston who breathe the toxic air from all this stuff. And I'd just like to make that clear that people think about those people too.
Great. And can I ask, did you visit it as an interested environmentalist, or are you working on something related to Keystone?
Yeah, I was in East Texas actively protesting it. So.
Got it. Thanks so much for your call. And let me put this to you, Professor Goss. I mean, these jobs are temporary. Somebody described construction of the pipeline as the equivalent of constructing a medium-sized mall. Are we all overstating the size and importance of this as a construction project?
Well, Jessica, all construction impacts are temporary in the sense that the maintenance that goes on afterwards. And by the way, the caller was talking about only jobs out on the pipeline. You've got lobbyists in Lincoln, Nebraska, lobbyists in Pierre, South Dakota, and so on.
We want to get more jobs for those lobbyists, huh?
Exactly. Economists and lawyers. We may be the big beneficiaries. But the other point about going across land owned by farmers and others. In Nebraska, they're paying about, TransCanada, about $75 million in terms of easement fees. So that also has some impacts. But again, they are paying for those easements, but many of the farmers do resist it, do not want it, and that's certainly one of the issues.
So the other question we've been talking about, and we discussed this a little earlier with Governor Schweitzer, was whether this oil, once refined, will be sold back into the U.S. and used to reduce the U.S.'s dependence on foreign oil. Yesterday on ABC's This Week, Russ Girling, who's the CEO of TransCanada, the company developing Keystone, said thanks to energy consumption in the U.S., we need this oil.
The United States still consumes about 15 million barrels a day, and even with the production increases, only produces about 10 of its own, 9 of its own. So it still needs to import 6 to 7 million barrels a day, every day. And you can see that as far out in the future as you can see. And I would say that the best place to get that oil is from Canada.
But wait, on Friday at a press conference overseas, President Obama spoke about the pipeline and had a very different point of view.
Understand what this project is. It is providing the ability of Canada to pump their oil, send it through our land, down to the Gulf, where it will be sold everywhere else. And it doesn't have an impact on U.S. gas prices.
Okay, Alana, you're our fact checker. So, huh? Which one is the right answer?
In a sense, they're both right. I hate that I have to give that answer. They're both partially right. Mr. Gerling is correct that, and Professor Keith explored this a bit earlier, heavy oil is not something America is rich in. All this shale oil that's flowing out of the Bakken and the fields in Texas tends to be quite light. And refiners can't just work with light. They've got to have heavy. So this question is, do we want to get more heavy from Canada, or do we want to get heavy oils from Mexico, Venezuela? An argument can be made that we are already buying a lot of heavy oil from Canada, and Keystone will kind of incentivize us to run more. That's probably true. The president actually is also right, because given U.S. demand being so flat to potentially declining, thanks in part to Obama's own fuel efficiency standards, it's likely that a lot of this oil will be sold overseas as gasoline. Again, though, that is an economic benefit to America, because we did process it and sell it here.
But also, Jessica, Alana brought up the point earlier about 100,000 barrels per day coming from Montana and North Dakota that will be going into the pipeline as well.
Professor Gossett, so your point is that it's American oil that's
correct.
Going in.
In other words, the president failed to mention
that.
And you don't count climate. I think it's clear there's an economic benefit. But the talk about energy independence is a bit of a red herring. The fact is, even if the U.S. imported no net oil, we're still not even oil independent. If there was a big disruption in the oil market, say a nuclear weapon on a Saudi loading terminal, prices will go crazy and the U.S. will be just as hit as anywhere else, because it hits the whole global economy. We're a deeply interconnected world. So I think that people often imagine there's some kind of little independent oil markets. Oil is one of the most liquid global commodities. It really doesn't make much difference. This is a political talking point, not reality.
And Professor Keith, if environmentalists wanted to move the administration toward more action to stop climate change, isn't there much more he could do through the EPA, and it could have a larger impact than stopping Keystone, for example?
Sure. If they did something much stronger through the EPA on coal plants, that would be a benefit, and environmentalists have lobbied very hard for that. There are lots of things you can do. If you want to deal with the climate problem, you have to push emissions in the long run towards zero, not make a small cut.
How about a carbon tax?
Making it harder to get access to oil makes it easier to get alternatives in, be they electric vehicles or various alternative fuels. So it's a strategically sensible thing to do to try and slow down and reverse the growth of oil infrastructure.
Let's get in a voice from the origin of the Keystone in Canada. Jamie is calling from Montreal, not Alberta, but still. Hi, Jamie. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Jessica. First of all, I want to say there is tremendous protest on both the West and East Coast to expanding pipelines from Alberta to transport the oil to the East and West Coast. It's a very hot topic here in Canada.
Sorry, you're talking about the alternative pipeline that would take the place of Keystone if Keystone were not built?
Precisely, and this is causing an environmental tornado politically in this country. And I think a lot of eyes are in Washington to see what the final outcome of the saga will be. But I just want to make a quick economic point. I beg to disagree with one of the experts on your show who says that the price of oil is going to rise in the long term. It seems Canada is in competition with Saudi Arabia in terms of oil production and exporting its oil. Saudi Arabia right now refuses to cap its oil production and is doing everything to undermine the price of oil. So oil will continue to drop in my view, and it'll make the extraction of the tar sands more and more economically expensive and in the long term not very viable. So even if the pipeline is built, many oil companies which operate in the tar sands, which are foreign-owned, by the way, there's Total from France, there are Chinese companies there, they just might not make the fast buck that they expect to be making.
Jamie, thanks for adding a Canadian voice to this conversation. Professor Keith, does he have a point?
Sure. I mean, the fight, the political fight in Canada is amazing at this point. It's become a kind of central defining issue of Canadian politics. Which way it goes is really hard to guess, but I think it's very unlikely that all those pipelines get built. And personally, I think it's unlikely Northern Gateway, that's the northern route to British Columbia, gets built. There's a southern route called Trans Mountain that I think is much more likely. And there's a trans-Canadian Canadian route that I think is really quite unlikely. And this isn't just Canadian, to be honest. There's a bunch of U.S. environmental money and activist money that is working to try and block exports from Alberta to try and slow down the growth of oil sands.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Alana, if you could just give us a very short answer, two words. Is it true oil prices could stay as low as they are into the future?
Absolutely true, especially if this fighting continues on all pipeline fronts, which is, I think we all agree, it will.
Thanks to all of you. This has been a really provocative conversation. Ernie Goss, professor of regional economics at Creighton University and director of the Goss Institute for Economic Research, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Jessica.
David Keith, professor of public policy and applied physics at Harvard University and author of the book A Case for Climate Engineering. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks a lot.
Alana Shore, energy reporter for Politico. Thanks not only for speaking with us, but for being our fact checker.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you. On Point Radio is on Twitter and Facebook. Stay tuned.